from bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
Thanks, Ollie. Some of my Irish listeners are just pulling themselves out of the bed. Right now, the day after St. Patrick's Day. I'm sure there are too. It's no joke. It is Monday, the 18th of March, 2019. It's time for the first Richie Allen show of the week. Let's do it.
Welcome back to the most listened to independent radio show in Europe. It's your Richie Allen Show.
Yeah, Bukele, August, Collini, Donna, Bad Boys and Girls yesterday. Ah, had a couple myself, but I took it easy and I was in bed early.
It's the Richie Allen Show. Broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Well, the mainstream media has refused to investigate what happened in New Zealand last Friday. They really have. There's been no serious examination of the background of Brenton Tarrant, the man believed to have murdered 50 people and injured dozens more in Christchurch. Now, Sibel Edmonds is the founder and editor of Newsbud.com. You know Sibel very well, the author of several terrific books as well. She's in Turkey and she's been following this story. She joins me this hour. You don't want to miss Sibel Edmonds. And in the second hour of the show, I came across John McCone on Twitter. John got in touch. Fascinating man. A PhD in nuclear fusion. He's got a blog called Philosophy for the Future, where he discusses the political impact of technology on society and the economy. We'll talk about artificial intelligence, personal sovereignty. We'll talk about 3D printing. We'll talk about technology full stop and what it means for humanity and much more with John McCone in the second hour. And I had a chat with John earlier on. Smashing fella. Smart as a brass button. That's been polished and polished and polished. He's a really smart guy. So we're, it's a show of two halves today. No bad thing, eh? Show of two halves. Light and shade, my old boss used to say. Rest in peace. Right, 5 minutes past the hour already. Let's have a chat. Just before we talk about what happened in Utrecht today, not that anybody seems to have a Scooby-Doo. I know. I've used that cockney rhyming slang a few times in the last few days. I promise I'll stop. I won't use it anymore after today. Quick Brexit update. Very quick. The Commons Speaker, John Bercow, has ruled out the government holding another vote on its previously rejected Brexit agreement if, and only if, the motion remains substantially the same. Bercow told the Commons that parliamentary conventions dating back to 1604 meant that MPs couldn't be asked to vote on precisely the same subject twice. They rejected Theresa May's deal, MPs did, with the European Union by 149 votes last week. In January, it was rejected by well over 200, 230, I believe. Anyway, this is what John Bercow had to say this afternoon.
It has been strongly rumoured, though I have not received confirmation of this, that third and even possibly fourth meaningful vote motions will be attempted. Hence this statement, which is designed to signal what would be orderly and what would not. This is my conclusion. If the government wishes to bring forward a new proposition that is neither the same nor substantially the same as that disposed of by the House on the 12th of March, this would be entirely in order. What the government cannot legitimately do is to resubmit to the House the same proposition or substantially the same proposition as that of last week, which was rejected by 149 votes.
Hear, hear. So that was Bercow. Don't bring back the same thing again because you won't be allowed to put it to the House. some commentators this afternoon, including the Sky News, one of the Sky News Westminster correspondents, a guy called Lewis Goodall, he said that it's another example of Berko throwing a big spanner in the works and in Theresa May's plans. Doesn't matter, because Theresa May's deal with the European Union is a fate worse than death. It really is. It's actually worse than staying in. Anyway, enough Brexit. I know how quickly we're moving on from Brexit. This is serious. Three people have been killed following a shooting on a tram in Utrecht, according to the city's mayor. Nine others were injured. And the BBC is still reporting that the police in Utrecht are saying that this is a terrorist attack. And that's not clear yet. I'll tell you why in a second. They're after a 37-year-old Turkish man named as Gökmen Tanis. And they've warned people not to approach him. They put a photograph of him on the television today. And they've said, don't go near him, as if anybody would. But I think they kind of went in with 2 feet today, to be honest, the media over Utrecht. Everything was dropped this morning, as they always do. All other news stories were binned, and we had a live show of a bunch of Robocops standing outside an apartment building in Utrecht. They really don't look like police officers, do they? That's a story for another day, even though we've covered that as well. The hyper-militarisation of the police. They look like stormtroopers. So what you had was, you had a shot, a live shot of these guys standing around scratching their collective testicle while being outside a building, and it turned out this guy wasn't in the building after all. We were told it was a terrorist incident. Terrorism, they said. Terrorism. BBC and Sky anchors breathlessly saying the same thing over and over again and mentioning New Zealand every 2 minutes as well. This is Utrecht. And please believe me, dear listener, I'm not lying, I'm not exaggerating, I'm not being unkind. The disappointment was palpable. Honestly, heartbreak in the voices of the presenters when they found out that there weren't dozens of victims. Only 3 dead. Shite. I thought we'd have 72 hours of content sorted. Turns out, after all, it might be a domestic incident. Why am I saying that? Well, very late in the afternoon, a Sky correspondent in Utrecht spoke to some neighbours of the man that is currently on the run from the police. Now, this, of course, could change while I'm on air. He might be picked up in the meantime. I don't know. But his neighbours were spoken with, and they seem to think that it isn't terrorism or anything to do with it, that the guy, it was a domestic incident, and he may have shot a woman, and then he may have shot others who tried to intervene to help the woman involved. But again, it isn't clear. But the point I'm making, of course, not very subtly, of course, I'm not making it very subtly, is this is what the mainstream media does. They were just about to go into overdrive today, and then they found out that not dozens dead and dozens wounded. So a little bit of disappointment there for the MSM. I'm sure there'll be another one around the corner real soon. In New Zealand, in the meantime, there is an ongoing world record attempt in New Zealand. This isn't a joke. The record for the most haccas to be performed in one place by different identity groups. The haka. Most people know the haka as the tribal war cry of the New Zealand rugby teams. They perform this just before the start of rugby games, rugby league and rugby union, of course. Most prominently, people will know the rugby union, I suppose. The haka. Record for the most hackers. God be with the days of Roy Castle, rest in peace. How many different groups of people from different clubs and associations can we get to play the haka? Or to do the haka even? And they're all doing it at the memorial in Christchurch to the 50 victims who were murdered on Friday. Come on down and do the haka like it's 1999. There was a biker group, a motorcycle club, rode into town and did the haka. The motorcycle group. Come on! Shut up, fuck down now! Hooky! Shut the fuck up! So that's the bikers, right? Then some students, not to be outdone, the students came running down. On the students. Yeah, you get the picture. Loads of hackers being performed. This is still going on. I've actually knocked on the door of old Lizzie across the road. Lizzie runs the bridge club, the local bridge club. She's 70 years of age. She's the president. So get on a plane, Lizzie, before some other bridge club decides to do the hacker. Get all the old dears on the red eye to New Zealand. Get out there, pull your socks up, tuck your skirts in and do the hacker. Thomas Cook should even run a package. Festival of attention seeking, the outpouring of which this total fake grief. Andy Warhol was right. Everybody will be famous for 15 minutes in the future. I think we've arrived in the future. Well, it's madness, isn't it? You're living in a lunatic asylum. Groups of people, different groups, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, Tiddlywinks clubs, all coming down. Park runners, let's do the haka. Do the haka. Get on telly while the cameras are still there. Why not? Show how much you care. Show how worthwhile you are. In the meantime, New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern has said she will announce detailed gun law reforms within days. Ardern said her cabinet had backed gun law changes in principle. Brenton Tarrant has been charged with murder, as you know. Police said he used military-style assault weapons modified to make them more deadly. How did he do that? Don't know. So many unanswered questions. But you know, the answers are actually unimportant right now. What's really important are the questions. But nobody in the UK, MSM, or in New Zealand, MSM, or anywhere else is asking the basic questions. This is what you get on national television and radio. Nothing. That's why we've got Sybil Edmonds coming on. LBC's James O'Brien. This is what you can expect from UK mainstream television and radio. Listen to this from James O'Brien talking about, well, just talking bollocks, basically.
Why have you picked a side in a battle between violent extremists? They are enemies of all of us, whether they're driving trucks up the promenade in Nice, whether they're blowing themselves up in the Manchester Arena, whether they're marching into a synagogue in America and shooting people dead, or whether they're marching into a mosque in New Zealand and shooting people dead. Why? What has happened in your world to make you think that you're on some way, in some sense, on the same team as these terrorists? Because I don't have the language or the skills.
That goes without saying.
Or even the contacts to explore how someone like Shamima Begum ends up getting radicalised. I know a lot more about it than I used to do since we read about her. And oddly, it's a work of fiction. The author joined us in the studio not long before the Shamima Begum story broke. The Good Sister by Morgan Jones, which has really helped me because it's painstakingly researched. It's really helped me get a slightly better idea of all that. But it doesn't bleep on my radar in the way that the Islamophobia does every single day. Every single day. And it hasn't made me think that that act of potential terror in Utrecht changes.
Ah, but there was no terror in Utrecht at all, James. You silly waster. You absolute cretin. An excuse for a presenter. London School of Economics graduate. Wurzel Gummidge was more of a journalist than you. It's not terror in Utrecht. You jumped in with 2 feet. Wait, hear what he says next.
Changes qualitatively when we find out who's done it. I don't care who's done it. My disgust and my heartbreak will be identical.
What a man. What a beautiful man. He doesn't care who's done it. His disgust and his heartbreak will be identical. Heartbreak. Multi-millionaire James O'Brien couldn't give less of a shit about the people in Utrecht or New Zealand or anywhere else. Festival of Virtue Signalling. That's what has become of the UK mainstream media. No questions, no real analysis. Just, I'm worthwhile. I am beautiful. Acclaim me. But then, to be honest with you, the independent media is worse than that. In this country especially. I've named the names before. The lawyers. You know, the Hoekstede lawyers. Hampstead Heath, all those liars. It's just as bad, if not worse, in the independent media. Where is the journalism? Radio 5 Live know better. They had Security Minister Ben Wallace on the breakfast show this morning. No serious questions. A lot of talk of far-right threats, but some very sinister news in there too. First of all, you'll hear Ben Wallace after he said the government has tackled the far right, pointing out that the government prescribed national action. Host Nikki Campbell asked him about that.
You mentioned, of course, National Action, the neo-Nazi group that you've banned, but how much of these people are part of terrorist organisations, or are they more kind of influenced by ideas?
Well, we see it also reflected in the latest sort of round of Islamist extremism. Is the internet has allowed these people to belong to an online sort of virtual community where they can radicalize each other, talk to themselves sometimes for months on end in their bedrooms, and import into their computers and their life extremist content. And that is a sort of modern 21st century challenge we have around this type of terrorist, that they often act alone. What we've certainly seen in the UK is most of the far right people that have been arrested or convicted of terror offences or are currently under investigation are loners, they're on their own. And they suddenly burst into violent extremism, which you can imagine is a huge challenge for our police and intelligence services, but also means that the signs that they show in planning an attack, for example, that would often give people away, are harder to spot.
Just out of the blue, they burst into violent extremism, but violent extremism doesn't cover shooting 50 people dead and injuring dozens more. Doesn't make sense, does it? These guys are living in their bedrooms, in chat rooms, and all of a sudden, bang, loads of guns, kill dozens of people. Does it make sense? Nikki Campbell then asked him, is the mainstream emboldening the far right? And Campbell mentioned the example of the UKIP poster before the referendum in 2016. There was a UKIP poster with a big long queue of migrants. So Campbell brought this up and asked, was this sort of thing driving people towards racism and towards the far right? This was Wallace's response. Ben Wallace, Tory government minister for security.
Let's address this. These people are, they have to be, surely, when we look at some of the rhetoric around, emboldened by the mainstream. Remember that poster, for example, that Nigel Farage used during the referendum campaign? The poster with a long, long queue of people with brown faces trying to get into the country. Do you condemn that?
Yeah, I condemn racism and I condemn Islamophobia.
Is that part of the problem?
I think lack of tolerance for people and extremist mindset is the problem, which we see in all parts of the community. We see it in the sort of white working class community. We see it in the white middle class community. We see it in the Asian community. We see it all over the country. We see too many people who feel that other people with different views are somehow lesser than them.
So was that Farage poster part of the problem, that breaking point poster during the EU referendum campaign?
I think it was just a scab on effectively a whole attitude that's out there, that we are becoming less tolerant in our lives and around the world. I think it's magnified by the internet, which allows people to go unchallenged in exploring their beliefs.
Unchallenged. The internet. This is very important.
Exploring their beliefs and testing themselves. And I think that means it's a really, really important thing that we all deal with extremism and intolerance. And, wherever we see that, collectively, as a society, we need to challenge it.
We need to challenge it. Now, finally, before we welcome Sibel Edmonds back to the programme, this is Ben Wallace talking about what will be done to tackle this online, and this isn't good.
What is fueling this problem is across society. You've got the yellow vests in France. You've got you've got extremist parties and a whole load of governments across the European Union. And what is fueling it is, in my view, the internet, that is allowing people to effectively remove themselves from mainstream discourse, so they can feed themselves a diet of extremist tribe and reinforce their prejudice. And I think that has become a game changer that we need to deal with. And that's why this government is due to publish something called the Online Harms White Paper.
The Online Harms White Paper. This is a white paper now. White paper meaning it's going to be government policy, and it will be, this will be a proposal for law, right? I'm not saying this particularly well, but there will be legislation. Once it's a white paper, this is proposed for legislation called Online Harms.
Paper in which we will examine what more regulation we can do, what more we can do to make sure that the internet doesn't become a safe space for this ignorance and extremism.
I noticed that you mentioned the internet three times in three of your answers, and it is very interesting. What you're talking about is clearly what you want to say this morning. But just encapsulate it for us, what the plans are. Are you talking about censorship?
Well, I'm going to have to wait, I'm afraid, Nick, until you see the white paper that will be published.
Yeah, you're just going to have to wait until the white paper is published, says Ben Wallace, who's a security minister in Theresa May's government. A white paper called Online Harms, which will be rolled out in the next few weeks and will detail what the government plans to do with respect to regulating the internet, going after these far-right groups or far-left groups or Islamophobic groups or whatever. Now, you know my next guest, you know her well. She's a founder, editor and publisher of newsbud.com, which is excellent. If you haven't checked it out before, check it out. She's an author, of course, of terrific books, including The Lone Gladio, a great political spy thriller. She also founded the National Security Whistleblowers Coalition. Terrific to welcome her back to the programme. She's in Turkey. Let's say hi to Sibel Edmonds. Sibel, thanks for coming back. How are you?
Thank you, Richie. Good to be back. Well, since the interview we had, I don't know how long has it been, 3 months, 4 months already?
Yeah, about that, yeah.
Well, this is the first interview I'm giving since then. So that tells you I'm really picky.
Well, you're busy. I mean, journalists don't often do interviews because they're busy putting stuff online and on television and on YouTube as you do. Thanks for putting that video out yesterday overnight about Brenton Tarrant. On yesterday's newspaper review programme, I was struck, as somebody who's gone through commercial radio, national radio, television, I've been in the mainstream for years before I became independent, I'm struck by how the alleged manifesto written by Brenton Tarrant was taken by the mainstream media and put into language for radio and television and read out as if it's, well, verbatim, this is true, this is who this guy was. It's lazy, it's wretched journalism, but thank God there are people like you with the inclination to start looking into who this man was. Because if you're only getting your news from BBC, from Sky, from CNN, you're not going to have a clue who Brenton Tarrant is. But you began digging, Sibel, and you've unearthed some extraordinary things about this young man.
Absolutely, Richie. Well, the first thing that raised my eyebrow was with the so-called manifesto and the repeated references, the obsession with Turkey, a lot of things Turkey-related, including Ottoman history of Turkey, and specific references to the president here, President Erdogan. And then as soon as I saw this, and this was within the first few hours, this news that he had been to Turkey, and this came out first from Turkish publications, and that he had been to Turkey at least two times. And as soon as I got and confirmed the dates, I started digging, because as an analyst, one of the first thing you do is you put that date and the person into a context. And I said, okay, I just want to check and see what was happening hour by hour from the moment this guy arrived in Turkey until he left, because his first trip or his alleged first trip, he may have been here before, but this is the one that has been confirmed, was only for a three-day stay. 6 months after that, he came back to Turkey and he spent 43 days. So I started with that first entry being the easy one, saying, okay, he was here for 3 days and I want to know what time he arrived and what was happening from that point forward. Well, I check his the information. He arrived early hour at Istanbul Atatürk Airport, and nobody has released where he was coming from. Was he coming from Australia? Was he coming from Germany? Because we know that this guy has been traveling to so many countries, Pakistan, all over the Balkans, including Greece, Western Europe, including UK. He has been even to North Korea and Israel, so Pakistan of all places. So we don't know whether there were other trips, stops before he came to Turkey or not. But starting from that day, he arrives in Istanbul Airport on March 17th, early morning, 2016. Within an hour and a half of that, the German embassy and German consulates, they issued this warning and they say they are shutting down both the embassy in Ankara and the consulate in Istanbul and the international German school they have in Istanbul as well due to very, very concrete, okay, and specific threats, all right? Now, you know, usually these kinds of threats, they are kind of ambiguous. We don't have much details, etc. But if you go and look at the articles, archives, the statements issued by the German authorities, they are citing concrete, okay, concrete evidence. So this happens within 2 hours of this guy arriving in Istanbul. Now, the German consulate is in Beyoğlu district of Istanbul, near Taksim Square. This is where all the Gezi protests, etc. took place. That's where German consulate and that German school they shut down is located. Now, this guy, when he comes, he checks in one of these mid-range hotels there in the same Beyoğlu area within, let's say, 2 to 3 blocks of German embassy, because that's also called the embassy room. Okay, now, this concrete threat is issued. Even Russia Today, Turkish newspapers, BBC, everybody covers it. Lo and behold, 48 hours later, 2 days later, while this guy is here in Istanbul, in this Beyoğlu district, while the German embassy and consulate, they're all shut down, this terrorist bombing, this is suicide terrorist bomber, that's what they said, blows himself up in Beyoğlu district within a few blocks of German embassy, within 2 blocks of where this guy is staying. And his targets were all these Israeli groups. In fact, there were 11 Israelis who were injured that day. 3 of them died. And 2 of these Israeli victims who died that day because of the suicide attack were American Israelis. They had dual nationalities, okay? The information that came out on suicide bomber was that this was targeted towards the Jews, specifically Israeli Jews, and he was an ISIS / Daesh sympathizer, and that was it. We never got any more information on this suicide bomber, okay? Now, this takes place, as I said, he arrives here, Tarrant. 2 hours later, Germany says they got a tip from someone and it's concrete and the shutdown happens. But there is no heightened alert in Turkey. Turkey doesn't issue this heightened alert, even though the embassy says it's, you know, German embassy says it's concrete. They shut down. They close it. They're both the consulate and embassy. This incident takes place. The terror attack actually occurs, okay, within a few blocks of the German embassy.
Amazing.
Within 2 blocks of where this guy is staying. And the next morning, with the early morning, this guy leaves the country. That's the alleged suspect, Tarrant.
After 43 days, Sybil, that was the end of his 43-day stay,
no,
right?
No, that was the end of his third day, because his first trip when he came...
Excuse me, sorry.
Yeah. Almost as it was timed with... He arrives, warning is issued, suicide bombing happens, the next morning he leaves. Then, 6 months later... He returns here in September 2016. This is right after the alleged attempted coup, okay? And he stays for 43 days in Istanbul. And now I have been gathering through my sources and research information. That's going to be another video. Bunch of terror incidents occurred then too. But this one actually raises more questions because when you're a country, especially a country like Turkey, and Turkey has a pretty, pretty active intelligence agency, MIT, MIT, okay? And you see that this terror incident happens. Anybody leaving the country within the first few days of the attacks has to be placed on a special list, whether it's you, Richie, or me, okay?
Oh, that makes perfect sense, Sibyl. Absolutely. In the immediate aftermath of anything serious happening, they're going to look very closely at any foreign national who's leaving
exactly.
the country.
Exactly, and yeah. foreign nationals leaving within, yeah. let's say, 16, 14 hours of this incident. Now, in addition to that, look at this guy, what the mainstream media is even reporting with all the countries he has entered. When you have a passport, okay, and I'm going to give you an example from myself. When you have a passport like this guy did, and this passport has a stamp of Pakistan and North Korea in it, you are already on every single country's list, especially in the West, especially in New Zealand, especially in Australia.
What was he doing in North Korea, Sibyl? Sorry to jump backwards and forwards, but this is really crucial information, and nobody in UK commercial or national radio is talking about this. How did he get into North Korea? What was he doing there? Why was he in Pakistan?
But see, nobody knows. Up any of that information, yeah. Richie. And if you go and look at this word, you know, sometimes with cases like this, the mainstream media likes to latch on one specific or two specific adjectives to use for a particular case that is ongoing. They keep using the word sketchy. Oh, it's sketchy how he got into North Korea. It's sketchy how he made the money financing all these travels. It's sketchy exactly when he was in Pakistan. Look, in this day and age of electronics, you can't take a piss without the big brother knowing.
Yeah, absolutely
okay?
right.
Anything you do, they know. Yeah. I mean, you withdraw $5, they know about it. You obtain a visa. To come to Turkey, he had to obtain visa. To go to Pakistan, he had to obtain visa. These are all leave massive amount of trace behind a person available to everyone. Foremost, to let's say, to an agency like National Security Agency, NSA. So for these people saying they can't gather, this is sketchy. I'm like, are you kidding me? This is not 50 years ago. By now, I mean, within the first 5 minutes of this incident, there would have been this long printout with every single details of entry to each country, the day he obtained the visa, what credit card, which one he used the credit card to pay for it. But they are not putting any of these things out. And for Turkey, this guy comes back 6 months later. He stays here. I will tell you for sure, there is no way he was not already on the list when he returned to Turkey in September 2016, after his first trip when that terror incident occurred. It's impossible. Now, another strange thing is happening here, and that is from Turkey's side, because Turkey was the first country with its media releasing this guy's picture with his entry in Istanbul Atatürk Airport. There were two, three pictures from the same few minutes when he entered and he was walking through the CCTVs on that March 17, 2016 that they said he came. But when I looked at the pictures, you know, the printout pictures, and I contacted the reporters I know here, and I said, look, every single CCTVs that people use in the world, especially the ones in the banks, in the airports, they come with the time stamp on it. It's the date, it's the time, and it's there. So you took this. Did you Photoshop it? Because the picture that Turkey released to the world that says this is a CCTV image doesn't have any date or time stamp in. Or is this original? Because it can't be original. I just get to be treated with the silence. They're like, oh, that's interesting. You're right. I will get back to you. But then nobody is calling me back. Why would you Photoshop the date and timestamp on this photo? And this photo is being marketed to the world. Here is the original CCTV photo of this guy, Tarrant, entering Istanbul Atatürk Airport. Well, where is the timestamp? Where is the date stamp? It's not there, and I want to know, and I bet you want to know, Richie,
oh, yeah.
Why was it photoshopped out? Because you are giving the dates, say he entered at this date, but why was it taken out?
The thing about, there's an enormous amount of tweets coming in here, by the way. We've got Sibyl Edmonds, the founder and editor, publisher of newsbud.com. You know Sibyl of old. She's not old, of course, but you know Sibyl going back after 9/11. whistleblowing, Gladio, all the stuff that she's been working on for many years. We're talking about Brenton Tarrant and his movements over the last couple of years, the very strange patterns of behaviour of this man who was in his mid-20s when he was travelling around the Balkans and Western Europe and North Korea and Pakistan. And listeners are saying to me on Twitter, you know, Turkey is beautiful, it's a great place to visit, nobody would denigrate Turkey. But coming back for 43 days, for a young man, unless he fell in love there, it doesn't make sense, Sibel.
So no, it doesn't. And this is the reason I made an, I wouldn't say a concrete statement, but an educated guess within the first 48 hours of this case. I said, based on these travel patterns and what I'm seeing, what we are all reading, the research, I can tell you probably we are looking at a network of cells, because you go there and there are other cells. This is not going to be one isolated incident. And my guess is, and we know that all sorts of information that is coming out by the mainstream media or even this whole event, there are so many unanswered questions. There are so many holes. I am not telling this guy, I'm not telling anyone this guy was acting alone, because I don't know. Okay, we are sitting here and we are being fed. We are always being fed. And then some information trickles out later, trickles down. But what happens is, you know how the term goes for ambulance chasers?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, there is this syndrome, especially since this blogosphere, internet age began. It's just like ambulance chasers. Majority of the people on the net, they have become scandal chasers, tragedy, terrorism chasers. People are going to like squeeze this case. How many accomplices were there? But I'm telling you, as it has been happening with tens of hundreds of cases in the past 10 years, including Boston Marathon bombing, after 2-3 weeks, there's going to be this exhaustion. People are going to get burned out. They're going to start yawning and saying, okay, let's wait for the next tragedy or the terror event or scandal so we can all chase it. Right now, everybody's chasing this. But when real information starts coming out, when people like me, like you, we research, we gather, we examine, we analyze, we start arriving at much bigger picture, much clearer picture, then nobody has any appetite. Nobody has any appetite. Oh, that's old case. Right now, I'm involved with this thing involving Trump, whatever, yeah. Or Mueller is releasing a report, or let's say there's another terror accident. People being so short-term and acting like these ambulance chasers, as the scandal chasers, and leaving it after 2-3 weeks, that's what allowing the mainstream media, the big governments, for them to get away with these things, because they know it's going to go away. They know even when the real information gets to be leaked or come out, it's too late.
You know what, Sibel? You know what? Some years ago in Boston, the people you described in the alternative media, a gentleman in Boston about 7 or 8 years ago, described them as the Truther Industrial Complex. That's exactly what they are. There's plenty of money to be made in making fantastic proclamations about things without actually knowing what really happened. And absolutely, it's sad, but that's just the way. And I know you've exposed some of this yourself in recent years. This Brenton Tarrant, could it be, now I don't want to sound, because I'm not sensational, could it be that a guy like him, if it was him, and it looks very much like he murdered those people on Friday, whether he had help or not, fair play to you, you're leaving it up there, we don't know yet, but it looks like him. Do you think certain intelligence agencies, and that's not, you know, me being cheeky, I'm not talking about Mossad necessarily or MI6 necessarily, but because of a worldview that certain governments have and that certain intelligence agencies have, are they watching guys like Tarrant and allowing them, not just guys like Tarrant, but also Islamic terrorists, allowing them to operate, maybe egging them on, maybe providing them with material support sometimes? I just wonder, there's no better person to ask than you. What do you think?
I think it's very, very likely, because as you know, Richie, they have been doing this, what you just explained, what you just described, since right after World War II.
Yeah.
I mean, this is exactly what they were doing. And this is before the age of technology with the internet, etc. This is what they were doing with original Operation Gladio. And this is not a conspiracy. And I know we talked about it during your previous show.
Yeah.
People can go and look it up, okay? Look at the encyclopedia. Even now, CIA, after its explorations, have been releasing some information. This is exactly what they did. Back then, they wanted to create the boogeyman with the communism and during the Cold War. These were the incidents they were causing, and they already admitted they did it all over Italy. They will set off bombs. They would assassinate people, and then they would set it up so that it would look as if this was some communist sympathizer cell, etc. So this is not a new phenomenon, but nowadays it's so much easier. Enter Gladio B. With Gladio B, this is after the Cold War, that communist, all they had to do was switch. It was replaced by the Islamic boogeyman. It was Muslims, you know, and then we had 9/11 with this. One of the things I'm seeing, I'm observing, almost as if it's going from Gladio B to let's throw a letter there and say C, because in addition to what we have seen lately since 9/11, Islam being on the other side of getting paired up with the word terrorism, in the past 2 years, we are seeing more and more of ultra-nationalist radical terrorists, the white supremacist terrorists, the right wing, and now it's kind of getting even more general than that, the right wing terrorists. So by doing this, there seems to be this push to, you know how it is, when you hear something 24/7 repeatedly for weeks and months, automatically, especially for the masses, your subconscious associates one word with another even without even thinking.
That's right.
Meaning, if you're Republican, you're a terrorist, I'm just throwing you. If you're right wing, if you're conservative, you are terrorist. The same way it is with Islam, okay? I mean, I was looking at the other day, the reports coming out. I don't know how much publicity is getting in the States since I have been here in Turkey for the past 6 months. So I'm seeing more of the European publications. Poland just released this report of documenting 365 children abused by the Catholic priests in Poland alone in the past few years. And France just indicted some high-level cardinal. So, and then all these reports are coming. It's this generalization. People are saying, oh, yeah, you know, Catholics are pedophiles. You know, it starts with some of these priests, they are doing this. But if this was to be publicized, then there's going to be these associations that subconscious is going to make. You know, you're Catholic, you're a terrorist. You're Catholic, you're a terrorist. You're Catholic. Well, the same thing we are seeing with these operations lately, but even with the events around the world, especially in Europe, you see it with Hungary especially, it is the word white supremacists, right wing, and it keeps getting more national. It went from neo-Nazis to the radical right wings. Now they're just automatically, they're dropping the other radical right wing terrorists.
Yeah. And the thing
I have heard a lot of people swing it back to me. It says, what do you expect? You are getting a lot of these white right wing terrorists. I'm like, hold on a second, okay?
You've joined, I'll tell you what, Sibel, you've joined some dots there in the last few days and months and years. There's no two ways about that. I'm massively impressed by this. It's cutting-edge thinking. Effectively, equate national sentiment with terrorism or something really terrifying. So there's a man...
And who doesn't like this, Richie?
Yeah.
Who hates this the most, you would say?
Yeah.
Right now, if you want to start narrowing it down to who benefits from this, who doesn't like nationalism, which entities or which groups?
Oh, well, it's obvious from my vantage point. You're talking about the European Union, the European Central Bank, the financial elites of the world.
You're looking at IMF, World Bank, the United Nations, the whole institutional like that EU has created. You're looking at the neoliberals, okay? You're looking at the George Soros of the world. They don't want to see this.
No.
This is not, it's kind of getting out of control. Of course, there has been pushback with their one-sided push for many years. This is why you're seeing what you're seeing with Hungary. They shut down all these Soros organizations. Every single one of them, they kicked them out of Hungary, okay? And you see the elections result in U.S. And the Trump supporters. So what you see is that is some of the things that that pushback has brought about. But some people up there, the ones with lots of power, they are not happy with it. So as long as people remind themselves and start just the dialogue you and I are having here, and instead of getting bogged down, was there blood? Was there fake blood in there? I mean, yeah. I'm seeing some people, they are putting the picture of this guy, Tarrant, and this guy that just did this tram shooting in this Dutch city. And his name is Gökmen Tanış. Initially, before any information was out, I was like, oh, is this part of the cell? But the more information I'm getting here, it doesn't look as if that is related, because this guy has a long criminal record. Tarrant has had supposedly zero criminal record, right?
Yes,
this
no Whitey was, yeah. Yeah, sorry to interrupt you. Sorry to interrupt you, Sibel. Sorry to interrupt you. On that, by the way, Sibel Edmonds, folks, newsbud.com. If you haven't checked her out before, I'm sure many of you have, check it out. This is brilliantly sourced work. Terrifically briefed, Lady Isabel. Great to know her. Great to have her on the programme. It's real journalism. There isn't much of it around, sadly, today. Honest, ethical journalism. Sibel, Sky News did something good today for the first time since I've been alive. They interviewed some of the neighbours of the Turkish gentleman. He's maybe not a gentleman, but in Utrecht, it might be a domestic that. He might have been shooting or trying to kill a woman that he was having a domestic dispute with, and others might have tried to intervene on the tram. That Very might possible. Be the case. Yeah, something
That's
like that.
Because
yeah.
recently he was in court on some alleged rape case. We don't know if it was a real rape. It may be possibly related to that. His criminal records consist of petty theft, stealing bicycle, getting angry, etc. The only thing I saw in his background, and this was released about an hour and a half ago by Daily Sabah media outlet here in Turkey, is that he traveled to Chechnya and he trained with some of these Chechen rebel groups
Did
in
really?
Chechnya.
Wow.
And that has been confirmed. But other than that, every single thing that, I mean, what you just said and everything I'm seeing, I don't see at all any parallels there. Initially, it was, oh my goodness, maybe this is what we are seeing, other cells getting activated, but it doesn't seem relevant at this point.
Here's a question for you now. You brilliantly described there that the establishment has gone on the attack against people with national sentiments or feelings of nationalism. Here's the $64 million question for Sibel Edmonds. Do you think that people on the far right, some of them, might be clever enough, might be humble enough, as they are being attacked now and as their feelings are being equated with terrorism, do you think some of them might be humble enough or clever enough to say, wow, this is what they made us do to Muslims? I wonder.
You know, I this is, I brought it up as soon as this took place, because the question I posed was, I said, well, pay attention. Even with this case, for example, they will never put the religion of this guy there. Even though he's saying, okay, he was a right-wing, supposedly, whatever, supremacist, etc., they are not using white Christian terrorists, okay? And my question was, how would you have felt about this in every newspaper, 24/7, CNN, in the Middle East, in the West, every time you saw this terrorist name with the word terrorist, the words Christian and white was attached to it? And I said, you see how horrible it is. And I said, and it would be repugnant the other way, the opposite, vice versa would be repugnant as well. And guess what? You know, there are a few people here in Turkey, of course, during this passionate anger, they put the tweet and say, if they are not doing it, we're going to do it. Every time we cover it here in Turkey, we should put Christian white. I said, look, this is not a mathematical equation.
Yeah,
this is not a mathematical dynamics to say two wrongs makes it right. What we need to do is shame them. Just remind them and say, look, Do you see how it is? I mean, if you get all the mass shootings in the United States in the past 5 years, and it dwarfs all these incidents that we are seeing here in Europe, etc., and they are committed by people, and their religion is irrelevant, the color of their skin, irrelevant, even their nationality is totally irrelevant. I hope so. I really hope so. I know, and because the way I'm identifying them, maybe it's not correct, maybe it's incorrect, because I'm not.
You just momentarily lost the bell.
I have these people who follow me, and they are identified with the word MAGA, okay? So I assume that they are conservative, they are Republicans, they identify with the right. But I saw, I read so many supporting tweets coming from those people. And this is to answer your $64 million question, saying, right on, Sibel, this is very good. I did not get this, this is, this is an exception and et cetera, or actually blaming the victim, saying, well, Muslims are causing this. I didn't. I got a lot of these MAGA within their handle on Twitter coming and saying, bravo, right on, Sibel. That means yes. That means there are many people out there, I don't know the percentage of them, who are humble, who have common sense, and they can come and say, yes, that's wrong, that would be wrong, and the other way is very wrong as well.
Takes a bit of
and
courage,
that's
doesn't
heartening.
It? Yeah, it takes a bit of courage. I mean, we've talked in the past. I believe there is a global cabal, and it's a very small group. I might be wrong, but it's my belief, that has been controlling and manipulating events for a long, long time. And it's been able to do that because it's been able to divide us along the lines of identity politics, gender politics, racial politics, and so on. And I live for the day when people, whatever their creed or whatever their ethnicity is, when they come together and go, do you know what? We've been killing one another. We've been set against one another for generations and generations. And really, we should be focusing on our enemy. And the day that
Absolutely.
Happens, it's game over, Sibel, isn't it? It's game over for the system
well,
when
I
people
know
do
if
that.
You have had a chance to watch my little mini documentaries I've been making from Turkey. This is the first time I'm doing this kind of things. And it's called Bridge the Gap with Sibel Edmonds. And I am going through all these universal themes here, a country with Muslim majority. I have episodes on the organic farms here, and together these people, activists with the farmers, they are saying no to to GMO, and they are doing seed bankings for the farmers, etc. But I'm interviewing them, and I'm saying, look, I know people in Oregon that they are doing the same thing, and I say, look how much we have in common, and I'm doing this in English. So far, I have 14 episodes out there. Initially, people were saying, what now? You're going to be Martha Stewart's, you're eating in a restaurant talking with people. You're going to the farmer's market. I mean, what is this? And I'm like, no, it's called Bridge the Gap. I just want to show in my way here while I'm in Turkey, because a lot of people from US, they have never been to Turkey, and they think Muslim countries, people have horns and tails and they look evil, or they think evil, or they eat evil. I don't know, because people are afraid of things they don't know about. That's where xenophobia comes from.
Programming
and
is strong.
I want
yeah.
to break that. Yeah, I want to show that we have so much in common, and that's exactly what I'm doing.
It's hugely important. It really is. I was lucky enough to travel in Morocco, and I was very embarrassed by the way people live there, the concern and the interest that they take in one another, the way senior citizens are looked after and their wisdom and knowledge is valued, whereas here we can't wait to kick our senior citizens into an old folks home. And I know some people are not able to look after their elderly relatives. I don't want to make anybody feel small, but I was just blown away by the difference in mentality and how people have time for one another. And as you said, the programming is so strong that even though the militaries of France and England and America and Israel have been murdering and mutilating people in the Middle East for generations, the programming is so strong that people look at Muslims or Arabs or Asians and they see radicalization and they see lunacy, when in fact, no, it's a tiny minority. And that radicalized jihadi was created by the intelligence agencies of your own country. That, you know, they have to wake up to this. It's brilliant what you're doing, Sybille. It really is important.
And that was beautifully put, beautifully said. And I would like to ask you a $64 million question. And I was asking that the other day when I was talking with my husband, because a lot of things you named, I think the media intentionally is enticing it. And I said, when are we going to see the victims? You know, you have people, you know, with the lawsuit-based society we have in the U.S., people suing. But have you ever heard people, victims coming together and say, we want to hold the media responsible for enticing this hatred? And therefore, we're going to come after you. I'm not saying going against First Amendment. I'm talking about intentional exploitations for profit and benefiting the interest that we are talking about. Because as you said, when they pair up those words, Muslims, terrorists, and they put it out 24/7, and if it is determined, which is pretty obvious, it causes that hatred that translates to hate crimes, let's say in some of the organic cases, then they do bear responsibilities. And my goal here and my intention is not to say, oh my God, we're going to have speech control like they have it even in some parts of Australia. You say this, it can be construed as hate speech and you're going to go to jail. I hate those things. In those time, you know, for those things, I'm more of a libertarian.
Yeah.
But to shame them saying you help enticing this and you do it intentionally. It is not unintentional.
No, it isn't. We've got about 60, 90 seconds left. Look how quickly that's flown by. I do wish sincerely that the next time you come on, we'll just do a show. I know it's a few hours later there. You see, you're very kind because you've come to the end of your day per se. I know as a journalist like myself, there's no such thing as the end of a day, but you're getting into the evening there and you've given us your time. It's family time for you, so I do appreciate that. Excellent work digging into Brenton Tarrant and what's going on in New Zealand and the lack of decent reporting by the mainstream media, which has vastly more resources available to it than Sybille Edmonds. Newsbud.com is widely read. It's terrific, but you can't compete with them. And in a couple of days, you know, you've exposed their total ineptitude by putting together this man's movements and asking the sorts of questions that that you have. So I'll give you the last 90 seconds. The final word is yours. Do say hi to Matthew, by the way. It was very kind.
Thank you very much. And I want to extend the same invitation again. We would love to have you here in Turkey with us. It's not too far. And there are some really, really, really bargain price airfares from where you are to here, Dalaman Airport. I would bypass Istanbul. It's too big. It's too mega. It's too dirty and polluted. But you can just fly directly here to Dalaman Airport. No, in fact, in about 30 minutes to an hour from now, I'm going to have a short video. I'm not going to be in it. I haven't had access to my camera. It's going to be on Turkey as a geopolitical hotspot for the events we're going to be seeing in the next few weeks. And I'm going to explain why that is. Some really major things are brewing here. Michael Rubin's via American Enterprise Institute on the day of this shooting in New Zealand put out this article, and it was hysteric. It called all Jews to leave Turkey because they're going to be all killed and massacred. And American Enterprise Institute, it is unprecedented. They have been doing a lot of fear-mongering in the past, but nothing to this level. I mean, this is unprecedented.
This is nonsense, yeah.
So when I'm looking, I'm going to be putting other information in this short 6-7 minutes video. Those of your listeners who want to watch it, because you need to watch Turkey closely. There's an elections coming. It's a major, major tension field elections in less than 2 weeks on March 31st. Turkey is going to be hot spot, especially with this stuff that we saw in this guy's case, Tarrant. So I'm urging everyone to focus on Turkey. And I'm getting some really uncomfortable vibes here for certain things. They haven't raised the alert, but things may be happening in Turkey. There are too many indicators on the ground to ignore. And I would say pay attention to what's going to be happening in Turkey, especially in the next 2 weeks.
Well, I'll follow it through you. When you put stuff on Twitter, copy me in. I know you've got gazillions of followers on Twitter, but copy me in anyway so I can retweet it to our listeners, newsbud.com. Sybille,
absolutely.
Thanks very much. Enjoy the rest of the evening there.
Thank
love
you,
to
Richie.
Matthew, and I can't wait to speak to you again. Great work.
Okay, thanks. Have a good one.
Thanks, Sabelle. The brilliant Sabelle Edmonds, newsbud.com, live on the line there from Turkey this evening. It's about 3 hours ahead there. Really good of her to come on her own time, private time for her there and her family. It's coming up for 6:03. You are with the Richie Allen Show. It is live, of course. It always is live. Monday to Thursday, 5 to 7pm UK time. Sunday mornings at 11am UK time. That's Sunday View. Lots of comments came in there. I didn't want to be interrupting Sabelle and reading them out, but a lot of them came in to see what other people have tweeted me. Go to twitter.com, and if you put Richie Allen Show into search Twitter, that's all one word, no spaces, Richie Allen Show. If you press enter, you'll see what people are tweeting me. As I said, it's really important stuff. Now, coming up in a couple of minutes, going to be joined by somebody for the first time. I'm really, really looking forward to it. His name is John McCone. He's a physicist. He's a PhD in nuclear fusion. Fascinating man. And he blogs about technology and the effects of technology on humanity. He's a philosopher. And I've been reading him, and I think you're really going to like him. So he's going to be on the programme in a couple of minutes' time, all right? And if you'd like me to put a question to John McCone, the simple way to do that is to tweet it to me. So if you tweet it to me, I'll get it. There are listeners who know far more about the nature of reality and astrophysics and all of that. The more, I don't know, what's the word I'm looking for? The more esoteric stuff than me. Lots of listeners who know far more about this. So get your tweets in. This is the Richie Allen Show. My name is Richie Allen. It is Monday, the 18th of March, 2019. Europe's most listened to independent radio show. Nothing like it. Welcome to it if you're just... Music from Slow Hand there. Bad Love on the Richie Allen Show. 6:07. Monday's programme. Ah, it's good to be alive. So it is. It's good to be alive. It's still bright outside. There's a grand stretch in the evenings, as many an Irish grandparent has said over the millennia. Really excited about speaking with our next guest. I really am, because these are subjects that I'm really interested in and that I know very little about, but I've come to start reading about and researching and looking into. He's a really interesting man. He is a physicist. He's got a PhD in nuclear fusion. He's written a couple of books. I'll plug those because they're hugely interesting. And he's got a website as well. And he writes a blog. Now, the blog is fascinating. It looks at where technology is impacting on our lifestyles and on the economy, where it's all heading. It's very philosophical, this. And... as I said, I'm going to tweet out links to articles that he's published in the last couple of weeks, the last few months. You can read a little bit later on. His website, by the way, is johnmccone.com. That's M-C-C-O-N-E. That's johnmccone.com. Delighted to welcome him to the programme today. John, thanks for doing it. How are you?
I'm pretty well. How are you?
I'm really well, mate. You know, I'm excited about speaking to you. We had a little bit of a pre-chat today, and I'm hugely excited. You know, I mentioned to you today that when you agreed to come on, my audience, my wider audience, has a huge interest in this subject, in technology, the speed with which technology is moving and the impact it's having on us. And I did mention to you today that a lot of people are concerned more so about the negative impacts of it rather than occasionally maybe pausing and saying, well, look, there's some very good things happening as well with respect to health and, you know, mobility and other issues, but in terms of the negative impacts of it. And I've been asked to put to you today, since I mentioned you were coming on, I've been asked to talk to you a little bit about artificial intelligence. John, it's a broad term, isn't it? Artificial intelligence. What does it mean? What do you understand it to mean?
An interesting thing about artificial intelligence is that the word artificial has nothing to do with the actual structure that you're talking about. I mean, artificial is just something that human beings put together. I'm a materialist. You know, I think that essentially that all of the qualities that things have are based on the material configuration. So artificial actually doesn't say anything about the material configuration. Artificial just says how it's been put together. So if you took a bunch of atoms and you put them in the configuration of a human being, that human being would be an artificial intelligence.
Right, okay.
So actually, artificial intelligence could, in principle, be any kind of intelligence if it was put together by people. So artificial intelligence can be absolutely anything. At the moment, the most intelligent systems that human beings are building are multi-layered neural networks, I think. So multi-layered neural networks are like the in thing at the moment. And
what does these neural networks, these artificial ones, I know artificial is the wrong term now, thanks for correcting us on that, what do they do? What are they capable of doing?
They seem to be capable of anything. I think when these, like, I mean, I'm not a technical expert on neural networks, from what I read, deep learning systems are capable of doing pretty much anything. That you have to train them to do them in the first place. Once you have a deep learning system, you have to like train it, and it'll get good at what it's trained to do. But it's like interesting. I think was it Alpha Zero, was like could like beat the world Go championship, the world champion at Go, and after being trained for just one day, it was like it could beat the world champion at chess.
Wow, a day's training.
So, yeah, exactly. So like human beings need to train these neural networks by putting the right information into them. But the thing is that like it seems to be that the general kind of architecture of them enables them to be trained to do to play a wide variety of games and all sorts of things. Like I think was it DeepMind or whatever, you train it a little bit, you train it for one video game, suddenly it's an expert in that video game. Train it for another video game, suddenly it's an expert in that video game. Train it I think, and this is like Super Mario, Tetris, racing games, any game. It learns so quickly. It goes from zero to expert in less than a day. That's kind of what we're talking about when we're talking about what artificial intelligence can do at the moment.
And when people hear that, John, one of the things that worries them is they worry about autonomy. They think, at what point will one of these things become sentient? At what point will it be able to become aware of itself and its capability and begin to think and act for itself?
I don't think anyone knows the answer to that, really. I mean, we don't really know when it can become sentient. But I do want to say one thing, that the old arguments that science is not that scientific knowledge is not good or evil, but only the use of it is good or evil, doesn't apply to artificial intelligence. Because the thing is, up until the development of artificial intelligence, essentially what scientists did is they developed technological capabilities, and they humans had to decide how to use those capabilities. But once we develop artificial intelligence, we are developing systems that can make decisions and act. And if scientists design systems that can actually make decisions and act without anyone else, once we design systems that are going to exhibit agency, I don't think the creators of those systems can wash their hands with respect to what those agents do. When a scientist builds a tool for somebody else, the scientist can always blame the guy who's using the tool and saying, it's not my problem, it's the guy who's using the tool is causing all this damage, I'm just creating the tool. But once scientists build systems that are capable of autonomously acting on the world, then the old argument that it's only how we use knowledge, that won't apply anymore.
One of the things, John McCone is our guest, by the way. Go to johnmccone.com. Read his articles. They're terrific, talking about the impacts on us economically as well. It's very important. It's not all about killer robots and killer machines in the future. It's about what people are going to do. John's a philosopher as much as he is a physicist and a scientist. How the impact on humans when maybe we can't go out and earn, maybe when we can't take care of ourselves because automation has gone so far that there's very little that we can do. We can talk about that in a minute. John's on Twitter as well. I'll tweet out a link where you can follow him there. This is fascinating stuff. And a number of people, John, just staying with the kind of scary future theme, a number of people, I won't name them all, but well-known tech guys and well-known journalists who've written about tech for many years, they're very concerned about the speed with which things are happening. Now, as a man of science yourself, have you, and you're a young man, I think you're younger than I am, or we're about the same age, have you been surprised by the speed of advancement? Let's forget about the early part of the 21st, excuse me, forget about the 20th century, the Industrial Revolution, forget about post-Cold War. Even since the turn of the millennium, the speed that things are moving at, John. Are you surprised by that? Is there anything to be suspicious about there at how quick this is all happening?
Yeah, I'm surprised. I'm really surprised. I don't know. Like I started out sort of. When I finished my degree, I did nuclear fusion. Then I did some work in nuclear fusion for about 10 years. And when I started, like, robots were pretty basic. And when you talk about like natural language programs and stuff like that, that the way that like robots can talk these days, humanoids, like, I'll tell you one thing, androids are coming. Like, you know, maybe warp drive is science fiction, but androids are gonna go. I mean, I think androids are the next serious disruption that we've had. I guess social media has been a major disruption. Good sides, bad sides, the internet, all that kind of stuff. But I think the next disruption is androids, and I think it's going to be on us very, very quickly. That there'll be androids walking around the streets in less than 20 years, maybe in 10 years.
John, did a country recently, refresh my memory, I think, did Saudi Arabia grant citizenship to a robot? To an android?
I think that was Sophia. Is
well
that
done.
Hansen?
Well done.
Hansen?
Yeah, you're spot on. Yeah. Now, that was a very bold and kind of dramatic thing for a government to do without consulting anybody. I mean, what did that say about the rights of human beings as organic creatures, that the government said, well, here's an android, it's a citizen and it has all the rights of, you know, Salah or Muhammad down the road? That was, I think that's problematic, John. I don't know how you feel about that.
Well, I'll tell you what I think. I think if you say that robots are citizens, then you can say robots have the vote. And if a government that is if there's a small government who essentially remotely controls, you know, half the voting population, that gives them a tremendous amount of power. That if there are like androids walking among us, and all those androids are sort of remotely connected, and they're just a giant swarm that's remotely connected to a few kind of sort of puppet masters who are human beings, possibly, quite possibly just human beings in government. You know, if the human beings in government are essentially the puppet masters of a swarm of androids that outnumber the number of people in society, then essentially they have total control of the outcome of elections.
It's as simple as that, isn't it? And I was disturbed. In fact, we connected last week, and since we connected, there's been a couple of stories in the UK press. There's one about people going to benefits hearings. I mean, this is horrendous to me, and I'm not trying to be a big dramatic virtue signaler. I'm not. It really is disgusting to me. So you might have somebody who's not in work, and he's got to go and have a hearing. They're trialling robots, androids, effectively, that will grill him. And not just in that sector, but also in the health sector as well. They've got robots, and they've even talked about, they've trialled getting robots to go and speak to senior citizens in homes, because we've lost all our own humanity. There's an irony anyway right there, John. We're losing our own humanity. We can't speak to our senior citizens, to our relatives that looked after us. So let's stick an android next to them to keep them company. It's mental, isn't it? Again, I don't want to be trying to be melodramatic about it, but it's a scary time, this, for humanity.
One of the biggest problems about artificial intelligence and androids in general is the fact that they allow bureaucracy to continue without limitations. Like no matter how bureaucratic, before the age of robots, no matter how bureaucratic a government is, you know, at some point, the weight of bureaucracy simply becomes too heavy to enforce. That, you know, at some point, it's like, okay, we want to create huge numbers of laws to sort of keep the citizens sort of all in line. But at the end of the day, we just don't have enough policemen to be able to enforce them. So we're going to have to like make things a bit simpler because this is unenforceable. And that's a really big problem with artificial intelligence, that the super intelligent computers will be able to process, you know, an infinitely bureaucratic system. So whereas in the olden days, systems that became too bureaucratic sort of collapsed under their own weight. The real danger with artificial intelligence is that it can make bureaucracy so cheap that bureaucratic systems can continually to get more and more and more and more and more bureaucratic and never collapse. The word Byzantine, I think, with reference to the Eastern Roman Empire, that that it became this incredibly bureaucratic system. Eventually it collapsed under its own bureaucracy. We could be facing a future where bureaucratic systems don't collapse because artificial intelligence can just do bureaucracy. And that's a really scary thing. Like, what if you have like artificially intelligent? What if the system gets so complicated that human judges don't understand it, human lawyers don't understand it, human prosecutors don't understand it, human juries don't understand it? You know, at the end of the day, if the system becomes too complex for human beings to actually understand or enforce, then, you know, eventually you might get to a situation where people say, look, you know, we can't have human judges anymore. We have to replace them with AI judges. We have to replace the lawyers with AI lawyers. We have to replace the prosecutors with AI prosecutors. If human beings can't actually run the legal system anymore, then essentially, you know, artificial intelligence could take be over, ruling us, sending us to prison, trying us in court, and just doing the whole thing.
Folks, this isn't scaremongering. We've got a scientist on. John McCone is our guest. John is a physicist, qualified PhD, nuclear fusion. He writes this really fascinating blog. It really is Philosophy for the Future. Go to johnmccone.com. His books are there as well. You got to be supporting people like this. There aren't very many people talking about this and the impact that it's having and will have. Really interesting comment from Patricia coming in on Twitter. Patricia's asking about going into a supermarket now and using one of the machines, using a scanning machine, which has taken the place of a cashier. It's something I've lamented, again, not because I'm a really nice guy. I'm not a really nice guy. But I like speaking to the checkout operators when I go into a supermarket. When I was in school many years ago, I used to be a checkout operator. Now, often you can't get to one because they've shut down all the tills and you go through this thing where you scan them yourself. And Patricia is wondering, is that all part of a process to get us used to it coming in? And that kind of segues into the next thing. What's going to happen to us when we don't, you know, we could spend all night talking about the philosophy of going to work. We are the only organic creature on planet Earth that must work for another member of our species in order to live. It makes us unique, and we could philosophize about that all night long, but that's the way it is. What happens when, and it's increasingly happening now across every, sector, what happens when more and more and more, I mean, you just spoke brilliantly, John, there about bureaucracy, you know, never collapsing because eventually it becomes so complicated, but artificial intelligence can do it. We're seeing right now the very beginning, maybe we're already in it, the impact of technology on people and people's ability to go out and earn for themselves. This is of great interest to you, John, this research.
I mean, at the end of the day, look, technology is neutral. I mean, technology is morality neutral. It's simply power, and that involves the power to do great good, and it involves the power to do great evil. And I don't think you can really separate the two. Basically, when jobs aren't automated, the leaders of a country have got to secure a minimum standard of living for people. At the very least, everyone has to have enough standard of living to survive and have children and stuff like that, that the leaders can't push the floor living below that because they need people to run the country. They need people to run the system. Once artificial intelligence comes along, leaders will no longer need anyone. Now that's not to say that there's going to be any kind of mass slaughter or anything like that. It might turn out wonderful. Maybe people will be nice. Maybe we'll evenly distribute out the benefits of automation throughout society, and there won't be a problem. But certainly the minimum baseline of how a government treats its people won't exist anymore. The governments may treat people very, they'll have the power to treat people very well because there'll be so much wealth.
But they won't
also
though.
Have the power to just wipe everyone out, because at the end of the day, if you have a fully automated army and you've got like a button that controls it all, then you don't have to worry about soldiers having any crisis of conscience or anything like that. I think technology and automation, it increases our ability to do good, and it increases our ability to do evil. It's just something people have to be aware of. I don't think we should necessarily think it's necessarily going to be evil, but it certainly could be evil. The power can go one way or another. It can go to as technology develops, as our technical power gets higher and higher, it stands to reason that we're going to drive towards extremes.
Well, that's really important, you saying that, John, because to be one-sided, if I lose my objectivity for a minute, historically, if we look back at the great breakthroughs, they've often led to great harm, and, well, I would say more than great harm. Splitting the atom, what did that lead to? It led to the mass murder of hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Japanese in 1945, right? There's no two ways about that. Even medical breakthroughs over the years have been perverted and used to cause harm to people. I wouldn't hold out, and this is in no way now to knock in any way what you've just said, but I wouldn't hold out any hope that, our leaders and the financial elites of the world would do great good with this technology as it continues. John McCone is our guest, johnmccone.com. Check John's website, do read his articles. These are fascinating subjects for us, for people, for where we're going. John, you talk a lot about war, and you are concerned about that. And I've been reading today, your site today, you talk about something that never occurred to me. You talk about the advent of 3D printing, which is probably in its, it's probably in its infancy. Technically, probably in 2-3 years' time, the capabilities with 3D printing will be far greater than they are now. And you think that you're pretty sure we've got to keep an eye on that. Tell us why.
Well, 3D printing is actually just one specialized form of a more general trend of flexible manufacturing. In addition to 3D printers that can make any shape, you could ask for simply by inputting a CAD file or whatever. There are also CNC machines that will cut. They don't additively print, but they cut things. CNC machines that kind of cut up blocks in any shape you want. And generally speaking, and again, factories are also going towards flexible manufacturing systems where you've got an entire set of production robots and you tell them to manufacture one good, and then you just reprogram them to manufacture another good. And it's quite understandable why flexible manufacturing is getting, is a trend. And that's because, a manufacturing system that can make anything you want is more valuable than a manufacturing system that can make only one thing. So there's really powerful economic forces that are pushing towards increasingly flexible manufacturing. But of course, the thing is that if you can manufacture anything, that includes the ability to manufacture weapons. This is a really fundamental aspect of technology in general. It's really that power is power. There's technical power is technical power. You can't really differentiate it. It's quite hard to differentiate it between good and evil. So if you can make surgical equipment, and if you can make have the same system that makes surgical equipment or vehicles or cutlery or whatever, then that system, it's almost impossible to see how you could stop that system from making guns or missiles or killer drones or things like that.
And you talked about in warfare how countries that might have been traditionally on the end of imperialism, or countries that have been the small country, the David in the David versus Goliath, you know, countries in the Middle East that have been... Now, you didn't use any of those specific examples, I must say that. John hasn't used any specific examples. You might have mentioned Syria. But how those countries might be... I don't want to paraphrase it, you can explain it, but they might be inclined to get more advantage out of such technology.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the advantage of... the thing is that when you think about how technology works, it's about copying. That it's easier to copy. It's easier to copy value
than it is to
create value, to invent value in the first place. And as time goes by, that there's different kinds of information. Some information is easier to copy than others. You know, a book is, you know, in a book, if you want to get a book, you just press print or press copy, or and that's digital information. Whereas there's other kinds of information like work ethics or how a business culture is organized and stuff like that, or indeed, you know, arranging capital, you know, particular capital plant machinery that's much harder to do. And as time goes by and all of the information that an army has, all of the information that say let's say an automated army of like weaponized robots have becomes digital, and it's like literally the only thing that makes one set of weaponized robots more powerful than another set of weaponized robots is the plans. And that if you imagine like 3D printers, just generic 3D printers are capable of making these robots, and the only thing that's stopping country B from making the robots in country A is the plans,
the blueprint,
and those plans
yeah.
are stored in digital format, then a single computer hack could make a smaller country essentially the military equal of a larger country.
Do you know what though, John? Sorry to interrupt you. Do you know what? This is excellent. That might lead to a kind of a 21st century version of mutually assured destruction, maybe, where because the countries that have been bombed into the Stone Age, like Libya and other countries, and we can leave our politics at the door here, regardless of what we think of who's right and who's wrong, if those countries were then in a better position to defend themselves, we might end up with a world where countries just don't go to war, maybe. Or am I being idealistic?
I really hope so. I mean, I really do hope so. The problem, I mean, but I do want to say one thing, and that is that mutually assured destruction in the 1950s involved two superpowers.
Only two.
We don't know whether that works if there's, you know, 100 different superpowers that all have, or, you know, can all ally with each other in different ways. We don't really know if that works. Another really big problem is a blurring of the lines between peace and war. There's actually all sorts of ways to harm people these days. You can harm people economically. You can harm people by planting annoying computer viruses in their system and things like that. That's a really big problem with cyber warfare is that where do you draw the line between an actual act of war and a sort of annoying hack?
John, are you worried about the rapidly approaching cashless society? I am. I'm old-fashioned. I don't want currency to go digital because it makes it easy for a tyrannical organization or government to switch me off. Is that a problem in the future, do you think? It's in the news so much lately, isn't it? I mean, you can't, in some parts of the country, you can't get to a cash machine. The BBC ran a big story on it last week saying that the rollout of the cash society is so advanced now and we're not ready for it. People are not prepared for it. It's terrible. I would say, well, the real reason for it being terrible is is that we ultimately then have no control, no control over our finances. At least if I've got 500, I don't have, but if I did have £500 of cash here under my mattress, at least I have it and I can use it. With the cashless society, no transaction will ever be totally private. I couldn't meet you, John, and say, John, how much will you give me? How much will I give you for that lawnmower? You've got to. I'll give a 70 quid, Richie. No problems. That can't be done without somebody knowing about it. That's a way to wage warfare by proxy on people, isn't it? If all cash is digital, if money becomes totally digital, what do you think?
I think it depends on the government. I mean, just generically, as technology increases, the limitations, that the extent to which a government is naturally limited from oppressing the population are going to be removed.
Yeah.
That's not the same thing as saying that the government is necessarily going to do horrible things. We don't know. I mean, we don't know how politics and technology are going to interact with each other. But you can think of like a minimum, like there's a certain like bottom minimum that that governments have to do in a country that requires the work of human beings to keep running. In our existing society, governments and powerful people rely on everyone else to do work for them. And with technology, that's not going to be the case anymore. That's not the same thing as saying that it's necessarily going to be disastrous. But they will have an ability to oppress people. That again, like I mean, if in a really wonderful government, I mean, maybe cashless societies could stop. Cashless societies might in fact stop street prostitution. It might stop sex rings and stuff like that. If every time you pay a pimp for if every time you pay a pimp to have sex with a sex slave, you have to like get out your debit card or something like that, then that might actually, like, cashless societies could stop sex trafficking. So it's just another example where things could be quite like really good or really bad.
It's
a neutral thing. Yeah,
your balance is shines through the work. I've not been able to read everything, but I'm not going to lie, but I've been reading a lot today, and I've great admiration for your balance. But then you're a physicist, you're a scientist, you weigh up what might happen and what might not happen, and you try and avoid hyperbole, and I think that's fantastic. I, on the other hand, I've seen wealth go one way and shite go another way for generations, the financial elites through the European Union, getting countries into debt and then taking the natural assets of those countries and acid mining countries. I just see malevolence. I don't see benevolence. And I see the greater possibility of harm from this this advancement in technology. But I really love your balance. I want to mention again, it's John McCone. And I don't think for a minute, because some of my listeners, because of the nature of this program, will say, oh, John is naive. He isn't naive. He's presenting both sides of it. That's why you should pay attention to people like John McCone. It's johnmccone.com. I don't believe scientists are evil. I think scientists are brilliant men and women. I really do. I think the people who fund scientists, maybe, and again, maybe governments, again, maybe intelligence agencies, I think they are capable of evil, John, but I think scientists are good people. Scientists get excited about advancing technology. And listening to you, I'm reminded of a really interesting scene in the film Jurassic Park, where Richard Attenborough is very excited as the creator of Jurassic Park and how wonderful it is. He's delighted with it. And Sam Neill's character says to him, you became so preoccupied with whether or not you could do it that you didn't stop to think for a minute whether you should do it.
Oh, that's Jeffrey Goldblum, not Sam Neill.
Is that right?
Yeah, that's Jeffrey Goldblum. He was Malcolm. Ian Malcolm, yeah.
Well done. Yeah, yeah. Well done, it's Malcolm. Thanks for correcting me. You're a film geek like me. Yeah, it was. You're spot
on.
It was good. And you know, that stayed with me for a long time after watching the film. Do you think scientists are like that? Excited, wrapped up in the world they're in, the thrill of innovation. Do scientists often enough stop and think, is this a good thing or not? You know, where is this going to end up? What do you think?
Scientists are paid workers. I think scientists At the end of the day, like, I mean, we live in a society where everyone needs a salary. That, you know, if you've got a career and a family and if you can't bring in your salary, you get the sack and you don't have money to put on the table, then that's a really big problem. And, you know, scientists have careers, and I think scientists do often think about whether or not they should or could do things, and they think about the impact of their technologies. But no matter what they think, they've still got to bring in the paycheck every week.
Like everybody else, that's right. We talked about this earlier on. It's coming up for 19 minutes to the top of the hour. We've got John for another 10 minutes. Thanks for coming on, John. And if any of these questions are banal, throw it right back at me. I've got skin thicker than anything that any 3D printer could throw out. I don't mind, but these are fascinating subjects. They really are. The implications for people, you know, in the next 5, 10, 15 years. I know you're very interested in consciousness. We don't get too many physicists or nuclear fusion experts like yourself on the program to ask them about consciousness. And it segues back to artificial intelligence. I've come to think, and it's only a philosophy, it's only a theory, that maybe our consciousness is forever. It's infinite. And that it was never created and might never, you know, dissipate, might never disappear, Einstein and all of that. What do you think consciousness is, John? What part does it play in these discussions in, you know, this future technological world? What do you understand by consciousness?
Oh, God.
I know. Where do you start? Where do you start there? Yeah, I know that. Yeah. Like I said, you can throw it back at me if you want. But it's because I know you've talked about it in interviews you've given. You know, what are we? Awareness. What are we? What does a physicist think we are? Where, you know, forget religion. What do you think it is we are? What are we doing here, you and me, sitting here today? What's going on? We talked about simulation model today, you and I. We can jump into that
really,
for a minute.
I really have no authority on this at all. It's nothing to do with, like, any expertise. If I'm just gonna offer my, I don't know, ignorant opinion that's as ignorant as anyone else, I personally think that everything is to do with matter and space. I have no idea how consciousness comes out of how matter and motion relates to consciousness, but I do believe that consciousness is kind of matter. Somehow the physical arrangement of our brains, me being biased as a physicist, I suppose, that somehow the physical arrangement of our brains somehow produces consciousness, and I have no idea how.
Neither
but
do I.
But what I do think. Is that if you believe that, then that would imply that after clinical death, your best chance of not dying is to preserve the physical arrangement of your brain as well as possible.
Cryogenics.
I have no idea whether cryonics works or not. But it seems to me to be, you know, that cryonics as a way of treating people after they're dead. Cryonics would probably have a better chance of revival than any other burial technique. So I guess in that respect, I'm a bit Egyptian, you know?
Yeah, it's brilliant. I came across cryonics on your website. I was going to mention it there. And you're interested in that. I was fascinated at one time reading about that as well. And you know, people who believe in it and people who've taken the steps to pay the vast sums of money. And I don't mean to be facetious in saying that. I totally respect people. I mean, who knows? What I would ask is, do you think, has understanding the conscious mind, has it always been the final frontier for scientists? Ever since a man or a woman picked up a microscope and had a look at a cell or whatever, has it always been the final frontier, understanding our consciousness, the fact that we, you know, I think, therefore I am, I solve problems, you know, I dream. Has that always been science's final frontier?
I mean, there's no way to derive consciousness from the laws of physics. Science is about looking at how matter interacts with time, and the thing is actually that the perspective of science is always outside consciousness. that it's always about an observer looking at something else. Now, that other thing may be conscious, but there's no way for the observer to tell whether it's conscious or not. I mean, the only way that I know that you're conscious is just equivalence. That, you know, I say I'm conscious, and you know, you're kind of, you know, you have a, you know, I know that other people are like biochemically similar and they behave similarly to me, and I'm conscious and I kind of know what my physiology is like, and I see all these other people who have similar physiologies, so you just let's just infer that they're conscious. But there's actually no other than just giving equivalent things, other than just saying that things that kind of behave equivalently are probably equivalent in every other way, there's no other way of really telling whether something's conscious or not.
Terrific answer. And when you go on Twitter later on, John, you'll see there's been a huge reaction to you being on the programme. There really has. Yeah. No, there has. It's been terrific. Listeners are saying to me, loving this. Don't forget, Richie, to mention visible light to John. We can only see visible light, which is only a couple of percent of what's out there. And, you know, many a philosopher in the past has talked about visible light and what's beyond that and what might be going on outside of our field of vision and all of that. John and I touched on an interview today that I did. Well, John never heard the interview, but I did an interview with Rich Terrell from NASA about 18 months ago. Rich is a big cheese in NASA, as I mentioned to John today. If you put Rich Terrell into any search engine, you'll get the whole Wikipedia on him. He's discovered planets and everything. And he talked about how NASA scientists, but not just at NASA, but at MIT and other Ivy League universities. I'm not sure MIT is Ivy League, but basically that the heavyweight thinkers are saying now that they can see the mathematics in the universe, bringing us neatly around for the last few minutes to the notion that the universe is constructed. It's a digital construct, or most people say a simulation model. It's a simulation. You'll be aware that scientists have been talking about this for a few years, John. What are your own thoughts on it?
Well, I have to say that I'm not a heavyweight thinker on this. I'm an experimental physicist. I've done a little bit of quantum mechanics at college for like, I don't know, like a year or something like that. You know, a few modules, but I'm not a heavyweight quantum physicist by any stretch of the imagination. In fact, one of the reasons I did plasma physics is because quantum mechanics kind of freaked me out. So, I tried to pick a subject that was as far away from quantum mechanics as possible.
How did it freak you out? I doubt it freaked you out because you thought it was beyond your brain's capacity to understand. I'm sure that wasn't the case. Did it freak you out?
That was the case, actually.
No, I doubt it.
That was the case. Yeah, that was exactly what the case was. Like, and then I read this book called... I remember when I started out in college, I thought, you know, I want to know everything. I want to know exactly how the world works. And it was after I read this book by Brian Greene called The Elegant Universe that I decided, I just want to do something that's vaguely useful. So that's why I went into nuclear fusion. I have to say that like the real cutting edge of theoretical physics is it's not something that's my specialization.
I'm not a learned scientist like yourself, but I have opinions. And when I've looked at the simulation theory explained by people, there are some academics that are, they're very clever because they're able to explain it in layman's terms, at least what they understand it to be. And when I look at it, you know, it just blows my mind. I love reading about it and thinking about it and the implications. If it's a simulation, a hologram, a digital construct of sorts, that's got profound implications and throws 150,000 questions up straight away. You know, what are we doing in it? Who invented it? Who created it? And you've got to be, you know, whether you've not studied that or not, you've got to be interested in that, John. It's a incredible stuff.
Yeah, I think there is something I can say, and that is that regardless of simulation theory, we already are living in a simulation. The color, like take red, right? Red is produced by electromagnetic oscillations that oscillate that have a wavelength of I think it's 700 nanometers, And there is nothing about the experience of the color red that resembles the oscillations of photons that cause us to see red. The same with blue. You know, there's nothing about the experience of the color blue that resembles photons with 400 nanometers that have a wavelength of 400 nanometers. It's the same with sound. Like, think of sound. Think about high-pitched notes, low-pitched notes. In reality, what causes high-pitched notes and low-pitched notes are vibrations in air, and you know, the higher frequency vibrations cause high-pitched notes, the lower frequency cause low-pitched notes. I think there's a lot of take smell even. That what causes smell is the structure of molecules. But if you smell something, you get no idea of what the molecular structure of the molecule you're smelling is, because the sensation of smell has no relation to the structure of the molecule that you're seeing. So actually, like, to a certain extent, all of our senses are labels for what's actually going on, but our senses have really very, very little relationship between what's going on, except that it's consistent. That the only relationship our senses have to what's actually going on in the world is consistency. A photon that has a wavelength of 700 nanometers bears no resemblance to the sensation of red, and a blue photon bears no resemblance to the sensation of blue. But if you see two different objects that are colored red, you know that they have the same, that what's causing it is the same wavelength. And it's the same. There's like a sameness and consistency, but there's no real relationship beyond that. So to a certain extent, our brains are already simulating reality. That our brains are already just putting these kind of these sensational labels on things, but the labels don't actually resemble what they're describing that well.
Yeah, it's funny you're saying that, because Les has tweeted my next question. There must be something going on tonight with the old telepathy there. Les has tweeted, everything is a frequency, smell is also a frequency, not the structure of a molecule. That's in Les's opinion, but I've heard it said by many a researcher, and particularly those outside the mainstream, that, you know, they talk about everything being a vibrational frequency, and we decode it, and we then basically download what it is that we see around us. And it's stuff I love chatting about, John. We're just about out of time, by the way. Apologies for starting off in all different directions. I get a bit giggly. I get like a school kid, because we don't do this often enough on the program. You know, it's a hard news analysis program most of the time, but it's supposed to be looking at esoteric and, you know, and the scientific as well, as we've been doing today. Your website is really interesting. Your books, I've tweeted out a link already. I'll do it again after the program. It's John McCone, MCCONE.com. A genuine pleasure, John. You know, I mean it from the bottom of my heart. Thanks for coming on and giving us your time today. I really appreciate that. And I hope you'll be amenable to coming back on again in the near future to chat again.
Oh, I'd love to come back on. And thank you very much for having me, yeah.
It was an honour. Thanks for connecting. Cheers, John. Look after yourself, and I can't wait to do it again. What a fascinating man, John McCone. John is a physicist, and he's worked in nuclear fusion. He's a PhD in that. He's an author, and he blogs about, among other things, the effects of the advancement of technology on us as humans, but also on the economy for our future, everything. It's fascinating. It's really, I can't say that enough. I know I've said it a few times already. It's really, really interesting stuff. 6.5 minutes to the top of the hour. Number of you getting in touch with me. Faisal tweets, why do we not perceive sound as distinct as colour, or clearly see which colour is higher than another, considering that we are just detecting different frequencies? I wish I had the answer to that question, but it's the right question. Richard Angelis tweets, smell sensation would not work without quantum physics. Our brains are holograms, says Richard. Thanks for that, Richard. There's also been a lot of talk about my conversation with Sibel Edmonds in Hour One, a lot of commentary on what's happened in New Zealand and why, and Brenton Tarrant and his movements around the Balkans. Turkey, of course, he visited twice, second time for 43 days. He was in North Korea and Pakistan as well. Dreadful that the mainstream media has not picked up on any of it. It wouldn't do, of course, would it? It's not going to get into any of that. The place to go for more information on that is newsbud.com. That's newsbud.com. And there are videos on there made by Sibel Edmonds and her colleagues. So check them out. All right. Gilad Atzmon will be on the programme tomorrow. Cassie Crowhurst will be on the programme tomorrow. I've got guests booked in for Wednesday, and I think maybe one for Thursday, but I've not got the diary to hand. But I'll let you know, of course, over the course of the programmes this week. Let's see. Thanks to David, who says John was a top guest. He certainly is. Cartoon Drunk tweets, colour is produced in the brain. It doesn't really exist. All those pics of the galaxy by the Hubble telescope are false colours, coloured in by an artist, says a Cartoon Drunk there. Hi to Diane. A number of you commenting on your experiences with Muslims over the years. Sounds terrible like that to lump people in, Muslims. Ruth tweeted out, in the interest of balance, Ruth tweeted out earlier on that family members had very negative experience with a Muslim man. I retweeted that, in the interest of balance, my experiences with Muslims and with Jews and with Christians. I'm going to sound like, I don't know, I'm going to sound like what's his name? Charles Ingalls here. Mr. Nice Guy. And I'm not Mr. Nice Guy. Anybody who knows me knows I'm not Mr. Nice Guy. I've never had bad experiences with people. I've never had bad experiences with somebody who was acting based on their religious philosophy or their adherence to a code of conduct because of their religious beliefs. Never had a bad experience with somebody who was acting badly because of their beliefs. Ever. Not Muslims, not Catholics, not Christians, not Jews. All identity groups, by the way. A Jew is an identity. It's a chosen identity. Same with a Catholic, same with a Christian. You choose to believe it. Same with Muslim. Again, I'm not playing Mr. Nice Guy by saying that. Radical Islam is real. Jihadists hell-bent on doing unspeakable things to you and to me are real, but there aren't very many of them, and they were created by the intelligence agencies of our countries. The rest of the Asian and Arabic world are people like you and me. They just want to get on with the day, get through the day, go to bed, get up and do it all over again. I thought Sibel Edmonds is brilliant on that today. You know, ultimately, we have the same enemy. But we'll kill each other and spit at one another and call one another names and scream at one another from the sanctity of our bedrooms on Twitter, where we can use anonymous names, and have a go at nationalists, because nationalists are lunatics. No, they're not. Muslims are dangerous. They're trying to take over the world. No, they're not. No, they're not. Jews sit around their houses plotting on how to get everybody's money. No, they fucking do not. We have a common enemy. It's a hidden enemy. And someday, maybe, we'll wake up to it. But maybe someday we won't. If it is a simulation model, maybe someday we won't, and we'll just keep going around and around again like a hamster in a wheel. Like when Neo meets the architect of the Matrix, and the architect says to Neo, you've been here 1,000 times before trying to stop me, you ain't going to do it. Maybe that's the way it's going to be, maybe. I have no idea. This is Morrissey closing out the Richie Allen Show. Thanks to Sibel Edmonds. Thanks, John McCone. Speak tomorrow at 5. Bye.